One. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Racetech. Racetech suspension and engines, by the way. They happen to tune up some of the engines for factory teams. They sign the non-disclosures and all that, but they are still the ones that are building it and still the ones doing the work. And you're watching them every single Saturday night. If you happen to have Peacock, or if you're outside the US, you have that Stream Pass, which is pretty decent, actually. I've been watching that for a number of years and enjoying it. I am your host, Brad Gebhardt. With me on the line, a very, 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 very special guest, all the way down from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He's retired down there, I would assume. We're going to get to the bottom of that. The 133 in your program, Jordan Bailey. Jordan, how's it going?
What's going on, guys? Thanks for having me.
Hey, honestly, I'm looking forward to having you on, man. First time I met you was back in 2017, or I think it might have been early 18 when they started doing those, when you had just come out of the amateur ranks. You've moved on to different things. You're golfing a whole lot more. I'm jealous. This might be an excuse to book a flight down to Florida and you can, we'll play best ball. So essentially we'll just be playing your shot nonstop. But, perfect. Yeah, man, I'm looking forward to it. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Stoked to be here.
Absolutely. I'm stoked to have you on because, this sport is such a beautiful one and it can be such a brutal one. So many amateur guys. I even think of it, even like today, thinking about the roster that's currently on, Star Racing Yamaha. Let's be honest. There isn't enough room in the sport for every single one of those guys to be successful, let alone everybody else. It's a sport where if you're not winning, you're not really talked about. What have you done for me lately? It's always on to the next race. You had an amazing amateur career. We're going to get to that. 7 championships at Loretta Lynn's Amateur National Championships. 15 top fives, by the way. And I believe 10 times on the podium, including one time where you ended up, you were 15th overall in the 65 limited. But then you happen to be winning the 50 class. Not a lot of kids would be able to straddle both those motorcycles. You did it. If you got about an hour, we're going to get to the bottom of it. Sound good?
Yeah, sounds good.
Dude, first of all, lay the foundation for us. Where the heck are you from? And tell me a little bit about sort of getting into motorcycles and sort of how quickly it went from, hey, This is the gas and this is the handlebars and this is the track you're going to go around to I've signed you up for Loretta Lynn's Amateur National Championships at the area qualifier. And we're going to go chase this thing.
Yeah. So my dad got me my first bike in 2005. And at the time, there was Daytona Supercross and Orlando Supercross. And we went down to Daytona and Orlando and I begged him for a year in 2004. 2005, he got me a PW50. I think I maybe tried a couple local races, if you call them. But wasn't ever anything like I was going to be a dirt bike racer. 2006, my dad bought me a used Cobra 50. Met Adam Cincerello, was one of the first kids I ever met at our practice track, believe it or not. Watched him on a 65 at the time. And his parents introduced my dad kind of to the sport. And they told us to try for Loretta's. I haven't really raced anything of sort, maybe some local stuff. I ended up getting the last spot into Loretta's. And to tell you how big of a goon we were, so to speak, my dad rented a motorhome. I had a used bike. I had mismatched gear. I mean, we had all kinds of gear that we bought at a local store. He put the 50 inside the camper. It was like a fun mover. So we go down to Loretta's, and I believe I got 38th my first year at Loretta's.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, and I think probably the guys I beat didn't finish the 3 motos because the last moto was horrific mud.
Okay, yeah.
So at that point, I don't believe we even did Minios, which was 2 hours away from Orlando and Gainesville. And the next following year, my dad had bought me a new Cobra 50.
Okay.
And
Chase Sexton beat you that year, by the way. He got 11th overall.
Wow.
On a lem.
That's terrible.
I need to text Chase Sexton about racing a lem.
I would love to have Chase is one of my dear buddies, and God, that's
you
painful
ask
to
him
think.
about that.
That's painful to think he beat me on that dinosaur.
Yeah. And the championship was won by Sean Cantrell, which
I
is
know
kind of
it.
topical.
I know it. And yeah, so I mean, we did the Spring Nationals, which was Lake Whitney and Oak Hill. I won a title at each of those. And that kind of snowballed everything. You know, I all of a sudden winning amateur nationals. We went to World Mini to, you know, my dad at World Mini, because it was, I don't even remember the time of the year, Easter time. I remember doing World Mini, him putting me on a flight home to make it to school the next day. I mean, it was like a full whirlwind. And then I get to Loretta's and end up winning. In 2007, I believe, was my first time winning there. So
yeah.
I end up winning. And at that time, if you won on the Junior Cobra, they gave you a factory Cobra ride.
Yeah,
So,
it seems like that's sort of still the case now. Obviously, Cobra kind of just dominates the 50
yeah.
classes, but the kids that are on top, they shout those kids out from the mountaintops, which is honestly great because the kids love it.
Yeah, and I think Cobra, I mean, I still have two of them in my parents' garage in Orlando. I look at those things.
Rad.
It's unbelievable looking back now. Shoot, almost 20 years has gone by since that first title. But you look at those things and you're like, one, how did I ever get it off the ground?
True.
And two, to think that that was probably the coolest. I mean, that was the coolest bike ever at the time, it seemed like. And to see what these kids are doing today is completely unbelievable. But yeah, my career just snowballed from there. I mean, I just kind of kept continuously winning, and yeah, it went fast. That's for sure.
Certainly. So when you're a young racer at that age, and maybe we're getting like, maybe at like what I'm talking about is sort of getting closer to like 65s, 85s, super
yeah.
mini. When you're going to these races, and we can kind of get into some like the travel stories and whatnot, but I've actually talked to this about a little bit with like a guy like Daxton Bennick, where like you go to an area or a regional, you're not just expected to win because you're expected to win at Loretta's. This is a qualifier.
Yeah.
You're supposed to kick everyone's ass here. And you know it. Your parents know it. Your sponsors know it. And so do the kids that you're racing against. Did that ever like foster some like ill feelings or like shit talking from some of your, like, I guess competitors, or like, was there ever some basically like some cold shoulder, or some shit talking that you were on the receiving end of? Basically because, yeah, you're the big dog and, yeah, high expectations and all that.
Well, of course. I mean, I feel that everybody I raced, I didn't like while racing, you know, especially as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, ego, called ego, but you have to have that to be successful in any sport. You know, I didn't want to let anybody beat me, especially not in my age group. Right. And every race I went to, I wanted to dominate. You know, it didn't matter if it was a local race that nobody was at or Loretta Lynn's. I mean, the mentality never changed. And that was, I feel, what made every kid that we watch on TV today that's on factory teams that had successful amateur careers to pro careers was this, the fact that there, every time we lined up and you heard so-and-so was there, it was on. You
Yeah.
know, it was on and you wanted to win, and that's all we went to. I mean, my dad, every time we went to a race, we were there to win. You know, there.
Go on.
And I think, you know, my dad was tough in the sense of we weren't going to celebrate second place. You know, and he wasn't going to be over the top when I won. And the way
right,
I look
we're
at
expected
it today,
to win, we're supposed to win.
Yeah, my dad was like, listen, we come here to win. We don't play sports. You don't play sports and sacrifice the things that he had to do and what my family has had to do, like every family has, for their kid to race dirt bikes. There shouldn't be a party for second. You know,
Right.
there shouldn't be especially at the level I got to so quickly at amateur motocross. You know, there wasn't really a learning curve for me. It was, second year doing nationals, winning nationals. So that that point forward, my personal expectation was to win. I don't think my dad had to ever get mad at me because, I mean, I would freak out when I wouldn't win. And, but yeah, the expectation is to win every time I got out there.
Do you recall like an all-time meltdown of when you like just got became unglued?
Many unglued. I'll tell you a really good one. Oak Hill. Back then, it wasn't even an AMA race. It was when NMA and some of the other, I think Oak Hill was a different race, but I was racing the 57 to 8 class, and I actually, NMA races used to do 5 classes. And for whatever reason, I could never sweep all 5. It was always 4 of the 5. I had a bike break, like something always caused. And I remember I was out front in this 50 class at Oak Hill, last race of the week. And my chain fell off over the first lap. My chain breaks and I kicked my helmet the whole way back to my truck. I mean, full 9-year-old punting a helmet the whole way back to the truck. And I am losing my mind. I mean, just completely unhinged, temper tantrum beyond belief. I mean, I already won 4 titles or so that week. And that race, but that's how much I care.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, you know, that's just and a young man who's
I couldn't control not it used 9. To ever
losing. So
no, and yeah. I was never until I turned pro used to losing.
Yeah,
but that was probably an all timer. The old punt of the helmet for all the way back to the truck.
And what did Dad say about that?
He chewed me out for the temper tantrum. That's for sure. So, he probably laughed. I mean, as we get older, my dad's older now. I mean, I'm 26 now. If I asked him today, he'd probably be like, I was just laughing in the stands at watching my as some poor track worker is pushing my bike off the track. I'm just punting the helmet.
you're like, unglued. Pele, you're just kicking the thing. Any like bad blood or any hard feelings between moto dads, or did your dad ever get into it with anybody?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So good.
Many times, actually. I remember, don't remember the kid's name. He never really raced. He was kind of around for the Winter Am series down in Orlando, and I was racing the 85, 12 to 13 class, and I could race one of the super mini classes at the time, and he wasn't really any good, but they were claiming that I was cheating. And which was funny enough because I was racing at 85 in the super mini class. And I don't know if you knew the KTMs back then. If you ran the super mini head, it was significantly bigger than the 85 head.
Okay.
So, it's typical amateur motocross, you know, and never even heard of this kid. And I remember my dad at Gatorback for the last Winter Am. He just turns around as I'm picking gates. And he's like, after we win this race, and this is the PG-13 version. After we win this race, you can take the bike home with you. Listen, my dad is 5'7", 5'8", 130 pounds.
Amazing.
And this guy is towering over my dad. I mean, and he just turns around and looks him in the eyes and says, after we win, you can take the bike home with you and have it and tell all your buddies that your kid just got smoked by what you think's an illegal bike. But KTMs at that time, the SXS bike, they called it, was so good for that era.
Oh yeah, they still are. It's the bike to be on, yeah.
In 2013, and he was like, you can have it. And it was just this whole meltdown. I remember we winning, and the kid goes by our truck and like flicks off my dad. And it was an all, and I never saw the kid again, ironically, which, That was probably an all time. There's a ton. I mean, my dad was probably hardest on me. There was many times he was my practice mechanic. I mean, forever until I fired him in the end of 2018, I fired him. But, yeah, I mean, there was many times I came around the track to some middle fingers at Alden Baker's from my old man. I mean, yeah, I'll tell you what.
And you found that to be motivating or?
My dad had a weird way. He was more down the reverse psychology route. Very, and I remember I was riding terrible one day, and he's pit and bless his heart. I mean, he's probably late 50s at that point, in the middle of the dog days of summer, as we're just pounding out motos. This guy could be doing anything. I mean, he's a financial advisor and chose to step away from that life of wearing suit and ties every day to being in a cow pasture, essentially, in 200 degree heat, watching his son ride terrible. And I was just having a rough day. And I remember coming around, and there's just no pit board. There's just two middle fingers. I was like, so now I'm pissed, right? Like, of course I'm. And I remember he was standing where they pit board at Alden's, was right off one of the straightaways. And I'm like, I'm going to hit him. Like, I'm going to try and get as close to him as I can. Because that, I mean, that was, I feel in a weird way, made me good, because there, like I said, as a kid, I'd be like, Dad, how do I look? And he'd be like, terrible. Just go faster. But my dad also didn't ride, you know? So like, he was never the riding coach or the, you need to do things this way. He was like, you just need to do it right. And he knew that my level of like what was right and wrong. And I remember that day I just like hugged his toe. He always wore flip flops and I almost got him. And oh, it was, he was flicking me off on a different lane. And then I think he just left. Like, I think he just packed it up and went home. And that was an all-timer there. That was definitely one that I'll never forget.
No kidding. Like the world of amateur motocross is such a wild one. Like nowadays it seems that the schedule has never been more like set in stone as to like what are the absolute races you need to go to in order to attract the eyes and be at those big races. Unfortunately, that's, I wouldn't say killed, but it's definitely hurt the local scene. Like you don't really
Oh,
hear about District 23
yeah.
champion, whatever. Like that's just not a thing anymore.
No.
Which is unfortunate because there's a lot of those kids that like, yeah, they're from Minnesota or they're from New York, but they don't race NESC. They're like the top kids. They're all at club or they're at
Yeah.
GPF or wherever. And like they're better racers for it, or at least better riders for it. You could argue whether or not they're better racers for it, but
Yeah.
They're not, which is why I said that, but,
No, I totally agree.
and, but yeah, like it's just like, so now like what you sort of have is like, you have these parents who there's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses. Me and the guys over at Verb kind of elbowing each other. Like how, like who's paying for all this? Like, and then, Brent Stallo just goes $650 for the rest, a month for the rest of your life, man. I was like, ah, payments, I suppose.
Well, it's sad. It's sad because, you know, parents will ask me, you know, how did I get good? The simple question of that, or what? And in all honesty, it was from racing. You know, I raced every single weekend. That was my training, right? I'd ride a few times during the week at a local practice track that wasn't the Club MX's or the, you know, the Millsaps training facilities or these places. And so but I raced and raced and raced and raced. So for me, you know, but even to the later part of my career as an amateur, the amateur scene, a local scene, had completely gone away. I mean, I remember it's come back more than it was when I was in the A class. I remember showing up to Winter Am races in the A class at the time where there was like eight guys on the line.
And
You
that's
know, and
very
then
common nowadays. Like pro class, five, six guys, 10 guys, maybe, and like two of them are old and just hanging out.
And but
65
then
class is small.
Yeah, so then it got to the point of like, all right, it's not worth the money now to go and race these local races. And so it just became training. And, you know, where the landscape of the sports changed for the argument or the better or the worse is the access to training at a young age, at that young of an age to, because the thing is, motocross, supercross, being a pro, that was my dream. That wasn't my parents' dream. You know, I had a nice motor home, Chase Sexton, and I had Outlaws, which were nice, but we didn't have double stackers. I never had a pit bike, never had a golf cart. My dad parked in left field every race. I used to have to walk 3 miles to get to anywhere. But we were there to race. We weren't there to put on a show and have fun in the pits and party. You know, in majority of my career, my dad had a Ford pickup truck. I went to regionals in the pickup truck. You know, I don't think now Team Green Factory Cali would love that their motorcycle's sitting in someone else's trailer while I'm staying at a Holiday Inn. You know, and but that's how we
Oh
did
yeah,
it.
no. That
I mean,
was
that's how we did it. We had our bike and we would have buddies with trailers. We'd leave it with them and just park with them for the weekend or whatever it was, and we would stay at a hotel and that was it. I was there to go to work. I wasn't there to have fun.
Yeah.
You know, winning is fun. That's what my dad used to always tell me. He goes, winning is fun. And in all honesty, it's the truth. But I think to the point of training, with how many training facilities there are today, with how many trainers there are today, and it's this nonstop competition of motorhomes and bikes, and the access to these kids on 65s can get A-kit suspension today. You know,
Yeah.
which is mind-boggling, which I think too, though, it's the evolution of the sport. Everything, technology's better. Everything gets better toward that. But
But there's
when
money
I,
there. The reason why it's better is because there's money in it.
yes, and there's more money that people spend. I mean, the sport has, you know, crumbled a lot of families in the financial world. A lot of parents assume that they can live off what their kid makes as a supercross racer one day. You know, that causes a lot of problems. My parents were never that way. You know, my parents worked.
Yeah.
They didn't touch the money I made as a kid. You know, they had jobs. You know, they kept the lights on. It wasn't, I wasn't, they weren't dependent on me. My dad was like, hey, dude, you just keep doing this as long as you want to, and that's going to be it. But I think the difference was when I had the opportunity to train at MTF in the summers for Loretta's, there was massive gain because it was everyday regimen training. You know, Colleen was and little Brian are world-class trainers. So when I had the opportunity to train, I would have a huge improvement because I was also stoked to be there. You know, all the way until my last day of riding there ever, I loved being there. And nothing bothered me more than seeing a young kid have that much invested into him through his parents and for them to not put forth the effort, the kid, to really get better. Because I think the issue today is just because you ride every day does not mean you're going to get better. You're going to get better from riding every day, but you're not going to show the gain that the parents are hoping for.
Right.
And a lot of that is, and I don't blame trainers. Like I didn't work with a ton of trainers. So I'd never been to Club MX. I mean, it looks absolutely insane for what they built there. But just speaking on Colleen and MTF and the program they have, I mean, we went there because it was the most successful program maybe ever.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the amount of factory riders they built, there's not a facility in the world that had come close to what they built. And also, too, if MTF wasn't successful, there would be no other training facility.
Right.
You know, they were the pioneer of this idea.
Yeah.
And
Come
now
here,
there's.
train, and like go balls to the wall every single day. And that's going to give you the edge to just have like more speed than anyone else who shows up that day.
Well, and I think the problem that I see in the sport that it kind of hurts in a way because I love the sport how I grew up is the sport's gotten more expensive. So the kid, it's harder for the kid to get into the sport, especially the kids from the Northeast, without having to make the sacrifice to go to a facility. You know, and that's a huge sacrifice. You know, that's tens and 20s and 30s, thousands of dollars a year just to be there. And then the motorcycles and just everything that's invested into their kid to go there. And the biggest thing is training facilities were built. MTF was built on kids that were already successful. You know, the kids that went in there were good racers and they become great racers. And now the training world, I just don't feel like Colleen. I can't believe, and little Brian, how dedicated they were to the C riders, the young 85 riders, the because it takes a special talent to train. I mean, I could say I could train people, but I don't have the gift to be able to sit there and teach a kid how to do something. That
Right.
takes a special craft. But I see a lot of these kids and I'm just like, it's not that they don't have a chance. It's that I feel that the parents have unrealistic expectation and that makes it way harder for the trainer.
Oh, for sure. I think like you sometimes you're trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and it's guys that like I could ride at MTF every day of my life until I can't ride dirt bikes anymore. I likely will never go as fast as you were at the pinnacle of where you're at. There's just certain guys that have that ability to comprehend the necessary skills to just drop those lap times and push. It's an ingrained thing, and like Colleen and everybody down there has done such an amazing job creating the program of what it is and what it's kind of evolved to be. But it's still at the very precipice of it is the most amount of success is coming from the kids that had they never showed up at all, it'd probably still be pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the when I was training there for majority of my life, really, the most impressive thing that's overlooked in our sport is in relation to golf. 15th place in golf is a good week.
Yes, and pays.
And pays, I mean, well beyond belief. But what I say, the realistic expectations, kids would come into the training facility barely being able to get around the track. And a lot of this is amateur motocross in a whole. You ask a parent, okay, what place is your kid? Oh, well, his lap times were just as good as the kid that got third.
I see a lot of that. I go to those
Okay.
like that. You're like your kid's in 22nd. Doesn't matter how fast
Well,
his
and
one lap
that's,
was.
I think if people took a different outlook on in a numbers world and in a, the finance background of my family, if your kid came into a training facility as a kid barely making it to Loretta's and the following year he got 15th at Loretta's, that's an incredible
Yeah,
gain.
that's transformation.
Yeah, and unfortunately in our sport, like 15th seems, you are miles behind and I've put in hundreds of thousands of dollars into this and he's terrible. But I think to the parents, okay, let's say your kid had one lap time. You can ask parents all the time, but my kid's a fifth place guy. Well, if you took all of his amateur national finishes and you averaged them, I promise you he's not a fifth place guy.
Yeah.
If you just simply created an Excel spreadsheet and put in an average of his national finishes or big races finishes, he's probably a 14th place guy. But if you did it from the year prior where he's a 28th to 35th place guy, wow, we've made some progress. But the expectation is, oh, well, the kid that's winning, his bike is so good. Well, that kid could win on any bike.
Right.
And that's where I believe that it puts trainers in a hard spot. And I think too, with the amount of trainers, if I had a kid for sort of speak that was getting into the sport, it's scary to me of like who my kid's going to train with.
Right.
Because, I'm biased. I trust Colleen more than anybody and little Brian because I trained there so long. But if you have access to somebody who's built, I mean, you can go down a list of amateurs that have passed through MTF, that have gone to MTF. There's just in my head, if you have access to that, that is the place to be based on statistics. That is the most successful training facility in the country
Oh, yeah.
on an amateur level. And, I see the amount of money spent in some of these with these trainers and other riders and things like that. And it's not that they're bad trainers. It's just to me, in my own head, if I'm willing to spend the money, I would give my best, chance to be there, especially now with Star Yamaha down the street. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, right?
Absolutely. Those guys have they basically revolutionized what it takes to, and what's required to win championships at the, it's funny because like you look at it maybe 15 years ago, you look at say a program like Pro Circuit and you're like, that is a button down program.
Yeah.
And then you look at what Star Racing has like
built.
created and built. And like, let's just say, like, for the most part, Pro Circuit and that team is essentially ran the same way it did 15 years ago. You're looking at that program, like, kind of loose. Like, you know what I mean? Because you
No, I
got
mean,
guys training all over the place, fill-in riders, this, that, and everything. Star essentially runs a team as if it's like a football team. That we got more guys than we need, and we're gonna pay the guys that are gonna win this championship. They're all gonna ride together, and they're all gonna be crazy in shape, and they're also gonna be at the most advantageous location to harvest these skills in the case to
well,
be good at this.
the crazy part for me in the sport as a fan now is to look at, I was there in Tallahassee while Star was being built, and the idea of them building that and everything that consisted with it, I can't believe that other teams aren't taking this approach.
They're gonna have
You
to.
know, they have, but at what point, right? Like
Yeah.
we always say, like, they're gonna have to at some point take this approach. But at what point is these teams gonna take this step? Because you look at Star Yamaha, they train at their shop, right? If a rider's training in Florida and his team's in California and there's an issue, you have to then make a phone call, then you ship parts back and forth. There's this constant disconnect,
Right. On top of
right?
three time zones.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this constant disconnect of, okay, let's say we fly to California. Now we're on a completely different dirt. Everything feels different in California as it would in Florida. You know, now we're really not getting better. Where Star Yamaha's sake, despite having the millions of riders, they, when there's an issue, their shop's 20 yards away.
Right.
Right? The issue's going to be solved right then and there, or at least a plan's going to be put in place right then and there. And there's no guessing on who's fast and who's not.
Right, I would be curious to find out how many days throughout a year the entire, say, like, I'll just use Pro Circuit again as an example, but like, how often do all of those guys ride at the same time?
I mean, I would say before Anaheim 1, probably, let's just say at most a month before Anaheim 1, which is a massive stretch. It's probably 2 weeks before Anaheim 1.
Yeah.
The team gets together for photo shoots and things of that sort, and they make an assessment of who's going fast, who's healthy, he's going to go west, he's going to go east. But that's just not a, that you can't assess somebody who's been riding in Florida
Right.
and judge him on a 2 week time period. Or we say, okay, these guys are healthy, we're just going to take them. That guy may not be ready.
Right.
You know, if I train in Florida all off season and then my teammate gets hurt and I'm forced to go West Coast, I haven't spent any time on the West Coast, we might as well start at ground zero at Anaheim 1. The dirt's completely different. Suspension settings are different. I mean, everything feels different from where you train in Florida. And or vice versa.
Yeah.
And you know, the if people want to beat Star Yamaha, they have to take the same approach. But I think the problem with Star Yamaha is, how long is it going to take for other teams to start stealing their riders?
Yeah, well that's going to be the next thing is that the next program that creates a like a different version or like a basically like their own version of what they've got going on. And starts to pull guys like you're like, well, you won't be the big dog on that team because they have so and so and so and so. Come over here where you can be the you'll be our star. And like you already start to see little bits and pieces of that with like Triumph building what they're currently having. And like I don't really think that Honda per se is going to do something like that because they're very stuck in their ways, sort of doing the California thing. Although they have let guys like Shimoda go to Florida and I guess Chance as well for certain times, although he seems to be more proponent to like stay closer to home because I think family and all that is a little bit more important. Like that, but like honestly, if for those who know Chance Hymus and his like that the family unit that they have and the community that they have around Utah, like I'd want to be there too. It seems awesome. They have
Absolutely.
the Brough family is amazing with all of the tracks they have, whether it's Idaho or down in, is it, Delta, Utah, all that stuff. Like, yeah, it's fantastic, but, it is going to be really interesting to see, sort of how the other teams respond because, yeah, they won every 250 race aside from one this year, I believe. And with a couple of their riders getting a couple of wins, obviously you had, Davies and Deegan, just getting the lion's share. And it's funny because those guys are kind of the age group behind you, like, yeah. Had the story gone differently, you're probably well into a 450 career. You're only a year younger than, Hunter Lawrence, who, runner up in Supercross.
A year younger than Chase.
That's right.
People forget how
young Chase is.
Yeah. I mean, Chase is, he's even has a late birthday. I don't even think he's 27 yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, Chase is really the last guy of our generation, the last frontier of our generation of guys that still races. I mean, majority, I don't really, Fortner was two years older than me, a year older than Chase. And, you know, quite frankly, I never really saw Justin Cooper until my A class year. Chase is truly the only guy I can say I grew up racing with that is still doing it at the highest level today.
Yeah, honestly, like I don't know if this is a to besmirch the good name of the sport. People say, "Oh, motocross is a meat grinder." I'm like, professional sports is a meat grinder.
Oh, 100%. Like, doesn't matter the sport you're in.
Yeah, like there's plenty of guys who thought they were going to go to the NHL or thought they were going to go play professional football that are selling insurance now. But like the 250 A class 2017, your final year there, which it also ended up being your last outdoor national, oddly enough. Yeah. You end up second behind Justin Cooper. He goes 2-1-1. You go 5-5-2 ahead of Joey Crown, Rami Alves, Challen Tennant, Tanner Stack, Richard Jackson, Wilson Fleming, Kevin Moranz, and Yari Mitchell from the UK. The only two guys that were racing this last weekend out of that top 10 was Moranz and Justin Cooper.
Well, and yeah, I mean, Jay Coop smoked me that last year in the A class. I mean, when he got on that star bike, that was probably, in all honesty, Team Green had the best amateur motorcycle, and they probably still do. I think Star puts in the same amount of effort on their amateur program. And I go to the Husqvarna team, and our bike was light years behind on an amateur level of my
why at the end of 2016 do you go? You spent 3 years on Cowies, right?
2 years.
2 years, 15 and 16.
Yeah, so I spent 2 years in the B class on Cowie. You know, it's kind of a weird thing. Like, I was with Red Bull. My Red Bull contract, I did ride KTMs, but I did have an option to ride anything but a Kawasaki at the time because Red Bull was a little differently structured then than it is today. So obviously KTM, they wanted me to stay on a Super Mini, and I was way too big for a Super Mini. And Super Minis were not, they didn't have all the risers and the things they have today. And so I was just way too big. And I turned down Team Green a million times as a kid. And
that's kind of made
it. Yeah. So, I mean, it was kind of one of these deals. Like, we call Ryan Holiday. He gives us an offer. Wasn't anything over the top from what I had in comparison, right? I kind of had more of an unlimited budget as an amateur. Go to Team Green. I actually break both sides of my pelvis and my collarbone at Daytona, my first year in the B class. I was just way too light to be riding that fast of a 250. I mean, could not handle the motorcycle. So then Loretta's comes around that year. I believe I got second in something else that year. Fortner again dominated us that year, but then when it was my turn to win, I went on and won. And Marchbanks was my teammate at Team Green, who was already signed at Pro Circuit. And I was actually, believe it or not, I was like the last guy signed to a professional team, which kind of was sour. Like, you know, went 6-for-6 at Mammoth, and then it was kind of like I had an offer, and I was just kind of like, okay. Like, how long do I have to keep winning before I'm what I feel personally appreciated in a way?
Yeah.
You know, so then Husqvarna, Bobby Hewitt was a very, Bobby Reagan as well, where Bobby Hewitt personally, when he was running the Husqvarna team, he flew to MTF to meet with me and watch me ride. Bobby Reagan came down from Mississippi and watched me ride. And so I had two, you know, low ball offers that were on the table. And funny, Moto Dad, my Team Green, my pro circuit contract expired the Monday of Loretta's, and we didn't sign it, which is risky
You
because
crazy.
it was a lot more money than the other teams. And my dad was like, "We're gonna win this thing." And I go on to win both titles at Loretta's. And I was looking at things of Husqvarna wanted me. And in a way, it felt like they needed me. You know, they built an amateur program around me that following year with Jalik. They started bringing semis to the races. Before, it was, you know, there was no program. The team aspect was winning. You
Yeah.
know, Martin was winning. Jason Anderson was winning. To Zach Osborne was winning.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was like, well, this is kind of a no-brainer. And it was a team of almost, in a weird way, misfits.
Yeah.
It was like an outcasted team, and that just happened to somehow be successful.
Was Zach Bell still bopping around there, or Mitchell
No,
Harris? Is that
Zach
Mitchell
was already
Harrison
gone.
days? Yeah.
Harrison filled in my rookie outdoor season.
Okay.
He filled in for maybe, I want to say, maybe Moseman or
Oh
something
yeah.
during that.
Guys are getting hurt a lot.
Yeah, it was a brutal. That was my first taste, like, to pro motocross. Was just I had an eye opener. I got 19th my first race, rode the wheels off that thing, and had to ask what place I got.
Okay, so what's that like? Like you and we're gonna get it. I got some questions for you towards the end of this thing, but yeah, like I think like life comes at you quick when you go from basically a decade of showing up to the racetrack and like either being in the fight for a win or killing everybody, to like, I just crushed it out there. Hey, how'd that go? Yeah, that was 19th.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, pretty cocky coming into the season. Because Florida, like, I rode at Baker's training for that off season, and it was like riding my track down the street. You know, I've mastered the Florida sand my whole life. So I was pretty confident, but also inside a little like, I have no idea what I'm getting into. And I remember it really started on press day. Not even, I don't know really any of the tracks despite a Red Bud. And, you know, I take off and everyone's just sending it. And I'm like, I remember Jeremy Martin going by me and just being like, oh my gosh, like these dudes are serious. Like this is press day. And then practice starts and I qualify, I think 19th. And I'm like, this is unbelievable. And I remember the first moto, I get a good start like every rookie does. And Marchbanks, who was my amateur rival, neither of us did good. And that's where, like, we went from being enemies to almost friends in a weird way because it was like, holy crap. Like, I was racing the dudes
Yeah.
I grew up racing with in amateur motocross, but I don't even know what's going on in the race. And then Glen Helen comes around. I felt a lot more comfortable there, had a decent weekend. But there was so many of that rookie season of like never been to a place. I mean, it felt like I was a fish out of water. And I was also not a guy who was willing to risk everything.
Yeah,
You know, I was
you're not
like,
Austin Faulkner. That guy will die
no.
for a plastic trophy.
Yeah, for me, like, I was like, listen, I am cool with this right here. Like, as long as I don't crash, like, I'm totally cool with where I'm at. And that was when, for me, I wouldn't say 18, I was pretty optimistic because we did have a really good motorcycle. But if we get into the details of Husqvarna, I was, I believe, the first rider signed under KTM with Husqvarna.
Okay.
So it was going from Bobby Hewitt's race team, supported by Husqvarna, to a full factory in-house program.
Right.
And 2019 comes, and if I think Jason won the 17 Supercross title. Don't quote me on that. I
18,
believe it's
18 Supercross title.
18. Okay, so 19 comes around and the motorcycle was, I mean, it happens with bikes. Like it was significantly worse. It didn't run. I remember the first day of the test track, we were all sitting there just like scratching our heads, like, what the heck? And it didn't really run. I mean, that was a big problem. It just wasn't a, and that for me the first eye opener was like Buds Creek. I believe it was my rookie year. Yeah, my rookie year at Buds Creek. I remember watching Aaron Plessinger. And again, I don't know, or sorry, Millville. I don't know any of these tracks. So I see Aaron Plessinger do the triple step up the hill. So I come around the next lap. I'm like, all right, I got to jump it. I didn't even get the front tire to the top of it. And I'm thinking like, whoa, like what is going on? And these guys on the star bikes are doing it from the inside.
Oh,
And
and
so,
those Star Racing Yamaha 250Fs, that I think that specifically that 2018 year, it wasn't even close.
no, I mean, 2018, 2019, I can very remember. And I remember in 19, we are searching for anything. And being that it wasn't under Bobby Hewitt, it was almost like a bit of a stab in us because it was like we really didn't have control. And it really felt like we were the step kid to KTM, to where it was like, this is what you got. Go out there and just suck it up. And for the people listening, the rear sprocket I ran on that motorcycle was a 1454 tooth sprocket on the outdoors.
You trying to do, you hanging out with the wheelie boys?
I mean, that thing could be put on a drag car. Okay. I mean, we were searching for power in any way we could. And I remember getting to Redbud. I qualified fifth in practice and I take off the second practice and it was Justin Cooper and Adam and me. And I found some outside line to get around both of them before the green flag. And I was jumping LaRocco's leap from the outside. And I remember just hitting the outside and Justin Cooper goes inside and he jumps it next to me. And I'm going, I got no chance out here. This guy's doing it from the inside. I'm doing it with my life on the line from the outside. And that was like my first, like, what am I even doing here? Like, I'm racing a Formula One race with a Honda Civic with a spoiler and a straight pipe, it felt like. You know, I'm like, man, I'm like, this is crazy. I'm like, I'm riding the absolute everything I have. And not to discredit their ability of Justin Cooper. I mean, the guy's a sicko on a bike. But at that point for me, I started to get a bit of a sour taste at the sport because the expectations for me to win, I'm not going to risk my life to win. I'm going to do the best that I possibly can do with what I have. And if I were to sign with Star Yamaha when I had an offer, my expectation is to win. I think that's why Bobby Reagan runs a successful program is because you go there knowing you have the best equipment. You know, that's what made Pro Circuit successful for so long.
It's the belief.
It's the belief. It's not even almost as much as the belief. You know this. You know, this bike has proven for a decade to be the best bike. You know, Swanepoel has proven himself as one of the best trainers to do it. You know, everything you have there. And also, too, you're under the pressure of if you don't want to do it, we have seven guys under you that can do it. You know,
That
it's
that's
like
got to
we
be a
will.
how would you have handled that atmosphere though? Because that is a very dog eat dog, they almost pit you against each other sort of thing. Like there's some guys who really flourish in that, and some other guys who are like, no, thanks.
Well, I think growing up with a more of a football dad, my dad played football in Minnesota at some tiny school. But the reality is to, you know, you got to be tough to win a championship. You know, if you're mentally weak, you're going to have good races. You're never going to win a championship. And the Star Yamaha atmosphere, it can hurt guys for sure. But I only think it doesn't, I wouldn't say it ever hurts a guy. I say what it shows you
It
though
doesn't
is
hurt
that you're not.
champions.
No, but I also think what better training could you have? Would Cole Davies, I mean, unbelievable on a bike, would he be as successful today if he didn't already see what it took to be the best? You know, if Hayden Deegan is the guy and I can be just as good as him at a practice track, imagine the confidence you have. You know, it's no difference between a backup quarterback going to the NFL, sitting behind Tom Brady, for example. You know, that guy is seeing firsthand the best to do it. So even if Landon Gordon had a podium. You see these guys that come in at a young age and they are surrounded by champions. They're surrounded by the best. Now you factor in the best bike, the winningest team maybe ever in Lights history, the training. So you already have the self-belief of that I'm doing everything that takes to be a champion, and now I'm seeing the champion. That's why I give kudos to the OG guys, Ricky and Chad and James. They rode by themselves.
They just stayed at home and guessed how fast you gotta
To judge without the technology we have today and the things that we have today, the social media world, to judge things. I mean, these guys were genuinely riding a loose program in comparison to today, making the assumption that they were the best. And what Star Yamaha has created, there's no assuming. Cole Davies knew going into the season that I'm ready to go. There was no assuming if Hayden Deegan was ready to go. We all knew this as fans, but that guy, I'm sure during the week, is just as good to, if not better than the 450 guys. So, I mean, that kid's coming into the season, he is going to decimate the 250 class, in which he did to an extent. But, that's where I think Star Yamaha is different, is because, and also Bobby Reagan, kudos to him. He doesn't take the whole team there. He doesn't take, we'll get it next weekend. There's no next year, and I think that's what hurts a lot of teams is they keep hanging on to guys in hopes that next year will be the year. Like, if we keep betting on this guy who statistically hasn't done it or stayed healthy or whatever it may be for the last 7 seasons, what makes you think as he gets older, this is going to change? Right? Bobby Reagan has that approach as a football mentality. You would never see an NFL quarterback in the league get hurt 7 consecutive years and not deliver, so to speak, a championship. He's fired.
They're
That kid,
gone. Clippy,
that guy's
Syria.
free agency. Now, the difference is they get paid $200 million on a contract. But so I'd love to be fired with a contract like that. You can fire me all you want. But that's where I think the sport, I don't want to see guys lose their job, but if I'm a team manager, we have to completely, a lot of lights programs especially, have to completely restructure what's going on.
Do you feel like sometimes the current crop of racers, like it is the best that this is the best racers in the world, but at times this is the best guys who kept doing it?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I was always told, well, just stick it out. Stick it out a little longer. Just keep going. And in all fairness, when I lost my factory ride, I wasn't going to beg for a factory ride. I don't even know if I wanted a factory ride. That I didn't even really know if I wanted to keep racing. And but the thing is too, it's like, am I going to train this hard? Am I going to put in this much time to hope to be a fill-in rider? To hope to,
Yeah, because like the only way to really compete at the level that you want to compete at, you would have to be a fill-in rider. Like, you're not taking with all due respect to a PRMX Kawasaki, like that bike is not going to the top step of the podium with
No, so like
a
I'm gonna go out there on a privateer bike and maybe sneak in an eighth, a ninth, a tenth, 11th, whatever it may be. Like,
Your best result on a Supercross. You were on Husky that particular year, but your second best result was on a privateer Honda.
So I mean, but it's like, again, the point is like, I'm not in the race, right? Like, I'm in a battle. Maybe I don't get lapped. Like, I don't remember getting lapped a ton, but it was like, it's just, I think the biggest thing in my head was, do I want to be a career lapped rider? And that's when I started to really think about things in the term of success, is like, if winning a championship is the only form of success in our sport in Supercross, then nobody's successful, despite of a small few.
Right.
Right? Like, I was a kid from Orlando, Florida, went to school, grew up with normal parents, made it to the highest level of the sport. Like, that's success. That's enough for me.
Yeah, no,
You know, that's
you
where,
were at the pinnacle of it, the absolute
like, for
pinnacle.
me, that was like, you know what? I did it. I got to say I did it, and that was enough. You know, and I wasn't gonna chase it and chase it and chase it and not get paid. You know, that's the biggest thing that comes back to it. If I'm a fill-in rider, I don't get paid. Maybe sure, my bikes and stuff are free, my parts and stuff are free, that's great. Maybe they give me travel money so I don't have to pay for travel and I'm on a bonus only contract. Okay. Who's gonna pay my trainers?
Oh yeah, I don't even get me started. I think people would be blown away to find out how little, like, the next tier is paid. And then also on top of that, how few of those riders actually have paying sponsors. I'd say, and like, there's even teams that I've sat and talked with them about, like, bringing in extra sponsors, or like, I've gone over with, like, say, Team X, and I'm like, all right, what do we get from like, how much does FMF pay? And they're like, oh no, that's just free product. I'm like, what do
Yeah,
you
I mean, a lot of
mean?
it's free product.
What do you mean free product? Like that, that's, there's that, to me, that's just some super, that's Mickey Mouse shit. Is that like what that they gave, like, obviously exhaust pipes are very expensive, but even other companies like seat covers or whichever, like, oh, we just get 10 covers and that's enough. I'm like, that's less than $1,000 worth of investment for the year. You get to be a sponsor of this team for less than $1,000?
Yeah, I
That's
mean,
wild.
there was to, in all fairness, I had more bonus structure and more free equipment and parts and gear and not so much gear, but as an amateur, you know, and that was a weird thing to me of like, I got paid as almost like a 450 rider and not the money, you know, not even close to the money of bonus 450 riders, but I was being paid by just about everything that I used. And then you turn pro and all of that's gone. And then you learn to find out, as I did as a pro, is like these teams pay for a lot of stuff.
Yes.
You know, the constant thing of factory teams is like the budget, the budget, the budget. And it's like in my head, I was like, how is there a budget? You know, but then you learn to find out like this stuff isn't free.
No.
You know, and that is a scary thing. And that's why, I mean, we could talk about my former team going away. I mean, that's one of
Well,
the
that's
precursors.
essentially why you're on the podcast, is that I
Yeah.
neglected to tag you on the, yeah, Husqvarna, Factory Husqvarna, whatever you want to call it, is, it's going to look different going forward. The team is going away as it is right now. That leaves guys like RJ Hampshire, who, he had some choice words. Him and I were going back and forth, over, direct message. And same thing with a guy like Malcolm Stewart, who his contract or his racing situation next year will look different. Likely on, possibly on a Husqvarna, but definitely not on that team. Yeah, that's closed up shop. That's big. Let's talk about it a little bit.
It's hard. And, you know, it's in the sense of being a rider, like I could only imagine getting a bomb dropped on you the way, because in my understanding is like none of these guys were aware.
No.
So it breaks to the media. I can only imagine as being on the team, people texting you and calling you and letting you know of what just transpired. And, you know, it sucks because it's like, one, how could this happen? But two, on the flip side, I'm glad that they did it. Husqvarna announced it when they did, because then it's early enough to where, you know, guys do have opportunity to find op other opportunity. But,
Yeah.
you know, I think the reality of it was bound to happen at some point, you know, with KTM filing for the bankruptcy
Right.
and, you know, gas going away. And I think the overall business model
was horrible.
Was probably the worst, and there's really no other way to put it. If you're a business person, the way that KTM's vision for this, the three motorcycle deal, was probably the worst business model anyone could have put together.
Well, but 100%, but that also, to me, is maybe the most glaring example of the fact that in the sport of motocross, I might get some flack about this statement, but in the sport of motocross, you have people doing jobs they have no fucking business doing.
Oh, well, and I think, too, that's a great point, because I had this conversation with my dad recently, and I was like, you know, kudos to the mechanic who works his way up to become a team manager.
Mm-hmm.
I said, because mechanics are way underpaid.
Big time.
I mean, just not even, it's not
if
even
they're close. Paid.
If they're paid. I mean, it's horrible what race mechanics have to go through to away from fame. I mean, just the sacrifice, forget the rider, that sacrifice is ridiculous. Okay. And then secondly, they work their way through the industry to get to a managerial role, which they're severely underqualified to do.
Yes.
In the business world, they understand
a lot
the
of them
dirt
have
bike.
No experience, no education.
No, so they understand the dirt bike better than anybody, but in the sense of handling sponsorship, you know, sponsorship money to budgeting to all of these things, I mean, they are severely underqualified for that role. And there's an immense amount of pressure that's put on them to basically lead a team to water and hope that that's going to win. And it's just like they're almost set up to fail in a weird way. And, you know, being a part of Husqvarna and KTM, what Bobby Hewitt had put together of a team of what I like to call misfits that won, you know, it's just an odd timeline that the team after they won became a full factory team. It almost felt, I'll tell you how it felt personally at where we were. It felt like we weren't supposed to win. You know, it felt like,
you're like the B team.
Yeah, it felt like in a weird way. It was like, how did this just happen? You know, because everything comes from KTM and it gets fiddled down, right? It goes to Husqvarna. And I do think of the, you know, parts and stuff are all the same. But in a weird way of my personal feeling, it was like when we were winning, it was like this weird tension between that fence that used to separate their shop. And the odd part for me was when KTM announced, I don't remember the amount they had the bankruptcy for, but I mean, in my head, I was like, how do you reach that alarming amount of money in dirt bikes?
Yeah.
Right. Because the thing is they had three motorcycles at three different price points, right? If I'm thinking of this as a business guy, if I'm a team manager, our goal, listen, our goal is to win titles, but our real goal is to sell motorcycles.
Right.
You know, that's what keeps us afloat. The sponsorship's great, but sponsorship comes easy when we're profitable and the team's profitable. And as a fan today, the only way I can determine what's a good motorcycle is by making the assumption of who's winning on Saturdays.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
like the,
Ken
the
Roczen,
win on Sunday, sell on Monday, it does still hold water in the eyes of certain people.
So if you have a retail buyer of a dirt bike, you know, and KTM is the winning brand, especially after, you know, when we had the stint of winning at Husqvarna, KTM's the winning brand, I'm going to buy the KTM. The Husqvarna was the most expensive bike.
The funny thing is that they weren't vastly different. Like they slightly different, different price point. But like when you order parts, they just come in it would say KTM genuine products on the side of it.
Yeah. So it was literally, you had a gas at the cheapest, Husqvarna at the most expensive, and KTM in the middle. KTM was winning the most. So if I can't afford to buy the KTM, I'm going to buy the gas. You know, Husqvarna is not in this picture.
Right.
You know, and that's why as a business guy, you know, I always looked at it like, how could we ever compete to sell a motorcycle? You know, there's two other options that are cheaper. One's winning and one's the same bike that's even less. So it just, the business model never to me. And then when they filed for the bankruptcy, that was when I thought things were going to fold.
And yeah, I think, you know, this was just like a 18 month later delay of that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, they talk about the economy. Everyone always talks about the economy of dirt bikes and the economy of the world and the prices of things. I get that. But if our goal is to sell motorcycles, you know, I in the long run, looking back, that was never going to be a successful business venture of trying to do the way they were doing it.
Certainly. And like, honestly, like when I first thought of it, the first thing that came to mind for me was like Toyota and Lexus. Like they're kind of like, you want all the bells and whistles, you buy a Lexus. You want something like durable and sturdy, you buy a Toyota, but they don't compete against each other.
No, they don't. They're two different markets.
Exactly. Whereas literally you have the exact same customer and you're saying, hey, we have not two, but actually three different options. You can win on all three, by the way. Here, like, you know what I mean? Like, what are you guys doing? Like, you're creating competition for yourself and then making the customer decide which one's better based on what color?
Well, and better yet, I mean, KTM came out with a new motorcycle every 2 years.
Yes.
You know, the Japanese brands have a full remodel every 4 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they make changes and things like that. But, I mean, massive redos are every 4 years traditionally. And so every 2 years you have a new motorcycle. Every other year, the guys on KTM are complaining about the motorcycle.
Right.
I'm not comfortable. It's a new bike. Blah, 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 blah.
We don't have parts.
These are the things that I'm hearing as a fan. So if I'm a fan, well, so-and-so's not really liking the motorcycle. It's a new bike. I'm just going to wait till next year.
Yeah.
So it's this constant kind of back and forth game of like, this is just a lot easier to go buy a Japanese brand.
Yeah. No, especially when you have a 2018 version winning championships.
Yeah, and I think Suzuki put a huge – I love Suzuki. I rode for Suzuki before they went bankrupt.
Your 85s must have been badass. When I think of Suzuki 85s, those things are trick.
I still have two of them. So,
so sick.
2011, I signed a crazy deal with Suzuki. I mean, there was a million motorcycles, parts. You know, they were top of the game 2011. I break my back training for Loretta's in 2011.
That's because you say you weren't there.
Yeah. So news breaks, bankruptcy. They're closing doors. So my dad and I are like, oh crap. Like we have nothing, even though I have an insane amount of parts and bikes. So the next year I went full privateer. I rode the Suzukis, won at Loretta's, which then granted me. And like, I was always held to the accountability of like, if you win Loretta's, you'll get this contract. If not, I was probably done racing 14 years ago. You know, like that's where the, you know, and unfortunately I won, but the Suzuki, that's the question that I asked today. Have bikes really gotten better?
I don't think so.
You know, personally. I think that was just proven. You know, a guy just won on a 2018 bike that you can pretty much purchase 98% of that motorcycle.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ken Roczen, I feel like could ride any motorcycle and be successful. I think those guys, Chases, the Jets, the Hunters, you know, those guys can ride any single motorcycle and be successful. And I think that now it's been proven that, and maybe not so much proven, but it's like, it's the question that repeats itself of like, are we evolving the bikes or are we just playing this guessing game of musical chairs of maybe this year is a good bike?
Because, yeah, I think honestly we've kind of gotten there. Like suspension technology is, I wouldn't say maxed out, but I don't know how much more you can really do with that. The start map stuff and the ECU stuff is kind of a tiny bit of a game changer, but like for the layperson who probably doesn't even check the air in their tires, not a huge difference. I would venture to guess that that's more or less the case, is that we're kind of just rearranging deck chairs a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. It's an interesting, you know, I think guys complain about the bikes too much.
Well, it's a good excuse to not win, though.
It is, but I mean, what I don't understand, and this is as a fan, I understand it as a racer not being comfortable. I've never ridden a bike and been like, I'm totally uncomfortable, but I also never competed to win on the professional ranks. But the biggest eye opener to me is like, obviously Cowie this year was very public with the struggle they were having.
Right.
You know, that was a very well-known thing this year of the problems they were facing, the extent in which they were going to try and make the bike, but it won two races. You know, and that's where it's like a head scratcher too of like, how are we saying that this bike is such a struggle, but it won two races? There's no car in Formula One that gets 12th place every weekend and randomly wins a race.
No, yeah, exactly. And
You know, that.
so far apart too, Anaheim 2 and the final round.
Yeah, so like, you know, that's where I think that there needs to be, and not even so much ownership on the rider. I think it's both that, and I think it's also, and I'm not just calling out Chase, but this is everybody on a bad weekend of we need to go back and test things. I think the teams need to be more straight up in the sense of a little bit of this is what we got. You know, because if we keep searching, you know, Anaheim 2 bike looked incredible, for example, for Chase. And Chase is a good buddy of mine. I mean, that guy is one of the best guys I've ever seen ride a bike. The bike successful at Anaheim 2, and we just completely eradicated that bike setting and gone down a different approach. And to me, thinking, okay, if that bike was successful, it won, you know, if we completely go just an entirely 180 degree turn from that, and we keep trying, if we keep and keep trying, we're going to then forget of what worked once, right?
Oh,
If we
yeah.
found a recipe that won, how do we find a way to make this better? If this is our baseline, because I just feel like a lot of these teams, when you're searching in that extent, and you just completely lose what's a baseline.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of teams that even they don't even establish a great baseline to begin with.
Trying and trying.
They just keep chasing that feeling and like getting further and further away from what would be like a really solid platform. And again, that sort of goes back to like you have an industry full of professionals, and I'm not gonna like just sit here and be like everyone in the industry doesn't know what they're doing, but it can be argued that like I don't know if there's a sport that has more people with less like tangible education aside from just experience in the sport as like as what their sort of quote unquote experience and what qualifies them to do that job. Like
Well, I totally agree. I mean, I've always wondered, you know, how is there not real engineers on these race teams?
yeah, the only teams that do have those types of guys are your like factory Honda and
Factor, yeah, exactly. So like if they utilized what I would say in the, you know, the F1 is the pinnacle of racing, and you know, you look at the detail of what those engineers can build, right? Like these guys hand make these cars to an extent. And it's like they understand that department of the car better than anybody on the planet, right? Like you hire engineers to build the product, and then you hire the middleman, the techs to piece it together, and then it gets to the rider. And I think that's where there's sometimes disconnect is. There's a lot of suspension guys who, you know, one never raced. And that to me is another argument. And it's hard to find a suspension guy that raced Supercross, of course. But in my head, there's no, you know, baseline in the sense of I'm getting info from a tech that's never hit Supercross whoops. Right? Doesn't get to see what I see going through the whoops. the amount of pressure that's put on the tech to figure out what's going on. Imagine pulling into the mechanics area and you have what, 30 seconds in practice to a minute at most to waste fitting, messing with the motorcycle. That suspension tech is completely freeballing. I mean, he is
Oh, it's just,
freestyling.
yeah, it's a educated guess. Like, oh,
I'm
let's
gonna
make it a
go
little.
3 clicks this way and two this way, and we are just throwing things at a wall and in hopes that that is going to be a determining factor. And in all my years of racing, I can promise you, I never checked my sag. Didn't care about that stuff. Never once as a kid came off the track and like, Dad, this bike's unrideable. Two, you can change two clickers. Come on, man.
When guys can say they can feel a click, I'm like, well, you're just lying to my face, but that's
Come
okay.
on. There's no motorcycle in the world that's capable of hitting the biggest bump on the planet and being like, I didn't feel anything. I will tell you this, and I'll keep all names out of this. I did get to ride a factory bike 450 at one point in my career, and that was a determining factor in me quitting racing right then and there because it was so good to the point of where I felt like I could take my hands off in the whoops. Like, no kidding, Brad, the way it cornered, the way, like, that was for me the way of like, I'm done. Like, this is it. There's people that ride machines like this. Like, that was for me at that kind of moment, I was just like, and then to ride that motorcycle, to feel what that felt like, which the normal person will never have the opportunity to feel that, and then to hear that guy complain, and this is really widespread. This is spread into the privateers of the sport, right? This isn't even just the elite guys. This is everybody in the paddock. I'm searching for this setting, okay? If you took a factory guy and told him to ride a privateer motorcycle, he will still be successful. Okay? There will be no change in result, but they will get to feel again, as if they were kids again, of what the bike is actually like. And that's where, people say if I had the chance to be a factory rider, you can have a factory bike and we'll all race stock bikes. You're not beating Eli Tomac. Like, it's that guy
Oh,
could
that
beat you on a 125.
you could beat me on a 65, to be honest. Like,
Like,
I watch Carson Brown, and I'm like, I'm trying to think of how, like, what bike could I beat him on if I'm on my 2026 KTM 360 300 two stroke? How, like, does it have to be a PW before I'm like confidently beating him? I don't know that I have him. When I see how he like throws around a KX 65, I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I have that. Which is upsetting. But
I'm
yeah.
gonna grab a phone charger real quick.
You're good. Like we'll get into some wrap-up questions here. This has been a lot of fun. We definitely have to do a round two on this one because you're too well spoken. You got too many stories. Barely scratched the surface here on the Big MX Radio podcast with Jordan Bailey. I wanted to ask what did you consider to be your home track, where you grew up? How did it become your home track? And like, if you had to race there tomorrow morning, how's that going?
Sorry, I'm back. If
Okay,
you
no
could
problem.
repeat that.
No problem at all. So like, what would you consider to be your home track? How did it become your home track aside from it just being a sort of close in proximity? And if there was a race held there tomorrow morning, how are you doing?
Man, so my home track growing up was called Bithlo. It was probably 30, 40 minutes east of downtown Orlando. It's now called Orlando MX. I tell you, haven't touched a bike in probably over 2 years.
Shame on you.
Shame on me. The last time I rode, I experienced arm pump for the first time, and I can tell you what, that's tough. To
Yeah.
all the
Welcome to
everyday
my world,
riders out
baby.
there, to all the local heroes and the average Joes call them, dude, kudos to you guys because riding is really hard.
God damn it. You don't know how good that felt for you to hear, for me to hear that.
Like mad props cleansing for you guys to battle five laps. Like, but if there was a race tomorrow, like what class are we talking?
I'm just
like a local, local plus, A class.
Plus not, plus 25, plus 25.
Yeah, I'm winning.
Okay.
I'm winning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, am I racing like Mike Brown? There's got to be some.
Mike Alessi will be there if there's plus 25.
I'll tell you, that track, I mean, I've eaten and personally tasted every grain of sand there.
Mm.
Like, I reached a mastery level of that property. And I feel that if I get a good 15 minute warm up, I might have to incorporate some stretching for the first time in my racing career. If we're doing like eight laps, yeah, I feel confident that I can win out there. And that's solely ego talking right now.
Yes, that's fair enough. And I think that was the proper way to answer that. I'm just going to ask you this straight up. Is being an amateur supercross or superstar in motocross as awesome as it seems? Sick bikes, tons of gear. You had some sick looks back in the day, by the way. Everybody's sister is in your DMs, all that. Like, I assume that happens.
I would love to have like this Hollywood answer for you.
Mm.
But in all serious, I mean, listen, there's multiple approaches to the amateur world. Mine was very less glamorous.
Okay.
It was, now I had this.
You did establish that earlier with the way your old man would park in the back 40.
Yeah. I mean, I was not, like I said, I was there to win.
Yeah.
You know, I was there for business. I mean, my dad used to say the best one liner ever at Loretta Lynn's is he would always say Saturday and Sunday and Monday, but the week, you know, leading up to Loretta's that Sunday and Monday, you know, you would see everybody there in the creek and riding around pit bikes and, you know, having a ton of fun. And my dad used to always tell me those smiles would turn to frowns on race day. And as weird as that is, and as maybe cocky or whatever it is, but it is the reality.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Believe it or not, I went in the creek for the first time when I was done racing.
Really?
Done racing. I never once went in the creek. I never once, and people would be like, oh, he was deprived. Like, I had the time of my life. Okay. Because I got to hold that number one plate.
Yeah.
You know, you had to have the car ride home in silence for 20 hours. You know, I got to enjoy the 15 hour, however long it was from Nashville mm-hmm. to Orlando. Like I got to enjoy winning and the satisfaction of the training and the sacrifice and all that to hear, you know, your name called and to go up there and stand and receive, you know, amateur of the year and the number one plate and the things that you used to achieve at Loretta's, like that meant more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that meant more than riding a pit bike on Sunday with your buddies.
Yeah. And right. Yeah, you were able to do exactly that. I actually got in the creek. The first year I went to Loretta's was 2022. And no, 23. And that was, I'm from Canada. So I wasn't part of that whole world as an athlete, but, Verb brought me out there. And, upon getting there, they informed me that, they didn't have a shower situation. So I bathed
took the portable showers.
Yes. I bathed in the creek. Oh, you creeked it every night.
So funny enough to that, my whole career at amateurs to show you how glamorous until my Team Green years, we stayed in a hotel. My mom, bless her heart, she'd probably kill me if she hears this.
Mm.
My father and myself showered in the portable showers. Now we wore flip flops and we should have probably wore hazmat suits.
I was going to say full Tyvek suit, the whole, yeah.
I mean, people talk about Woodstock 99, Loretta Lynn's
every
I'll
year.
Tell you what, every single year, you know, that's pretty much the, you know, in all fairness, didn't care. You know, it's like you look back and you kind of cherish those nasty experiences, but it's also like there's nothing like waking up to Loretta's in the back 40. It just smells like manure. It's always flooded in mud.
Broken dreams.
Yeah, and it's also, too, like, in a weird way looking back, I think my dad had this weird feeling. It was like, we made it. You know, we're back here with the not cool people, and we're out here winning titles.
Yeah, that is maybe the biggest flex, is to not be in with the cool group and then still take their lunch money.
Yeah, you know, we'd ride our stuff all the way back to the people didn't even know there were spots back there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's my amateur career for you in a nutshell.
Fair enough. So you've traded in knobby tires for golf clubs and going after over that world. And like, yeah, that's a probably a lot less dangerous undertaking, but I'm sure that there's some lessons that you learned all along the way with motocross that have served you well on the golf course. Tell me a little bit about sort of just like bringing yourself into the world of golf, dedicating yourself to it. What's your handicap? And most important question, who's the best golfer you've played with?
Oh boy. So I play off a +5 handicap.
Jesus.
You know, golf was kind of a funny thing. I started struggling, called mental health or whatever you want to call it. I just struggled with racing. You know, I truly, you know, I think to, you know, in a quick way, it's like, I don't know if I ever wanted to be a pro.
In motocross. You know,
in motocross.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I never thought about being a pro. It was never something that crossed my mind. You know, I just focused on whatever race was coming up next. Like, so if it was area qualifiers, regionals, local race, whatever it was like, I just want to win that. And then I'll go back to work and I'll just want to win the next one. It was just this little, you know, little path that I was on. I didn't see big picture in racing, supercross and motocross. And then when I got there and, you know, the everyday grind of trying to stay healthy, trying to get better, chasing a second a lap. You know, you're chasing something that doesn't exist, right? And it's like, to me, I don't feel that – I felt that I lost my passion, right? Like, it was a – you know, it was a lot of things that came to that. But it was like the bike – didn't feel that I was on a bike that necessarily could win, you know. And my trainers, Colleen and Brian, were putting so much into me, and I was putting everything I could into it, and it was just like – you know, 11th place.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's like, man, I rode well tonight, but I like, well, in relation to what? I'm still asking who won the race, right? I'm still watching dudes have these horrific crashes. Like, so I started putting that all into perspective. And then golf for me was my out. Like, I started playing when I had time off. You know, and for me, it was like, I just had this crazy passion for golf. Like, it was like my way to detach from racing at the time. I decide to step away from racing, start going to college. You know, I'm trying to figure out my whole life. And that first year for me was just like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I'm mm-hmm. doing college. I'm playing golf, not competitively. I finished college. I finished all these things. I moved to South Florida. And a Callaway golf representative was a member at the club I'm at. And he was like, why don't you just turn pro? And like, listen, I could shoot par. Like, I was a scratch golfer, but in no relation good enough to be a professional golfer. But it was the same process to being a pro golfer as it is to being a supercross racer. You just tick a box, states I'm going to be a professional. I'm going to play for money and I'm going to go compete. And I got lapped. I wasn't even making night shows. Okay.
Yeah.
But then, like I said, I had this passion of getting better like this. And then I just slowly progressed and progressed. And now, you know, I made it onto a tour in Mexico. So they play all over Mexico for world ranking points and money, of course. And, you know, I start making cuts and I start competing amongst these tournaments to where a lot of it feels similar to racing. It's almost in a weird way. Dirt bikes was it taught me how to be a professional athlete
Okay.
for what I do today in a
Interesting.
weird way.
Yeah.
And golf is such a different sport from racing, but it's still an individual sport.
Yes.
The difference of golf, I will say, from racing is when you go to qualifiers for the PGA Tour, it's 150 guys, 125 guys for two spots. You can't chase other qualifiers. You can't go to four area qualifiers and four regionals to make it to Loretta's. This is your opportunity to make it, and it's a sink or swim. And to me, I love that because it's like, you know what? There's nobody to blame. I'm the one that hits the golf ball. I'm the one that is in full control of everything that I do. And I would say that's the harder part from not racing is in a weird way, I can control what other people do, especially if I'm leading the race.
Right.
You know, I think Ken Roczen displayed that the best this past weekend in Salt Lake City.
I was so stoked to see him win that.
Oh, I mean, that is just monumental. That's a 30 for 30. And it's like the way he wasn't the fastest guy, the way he got himself in the front, the way he, you know, almost slowed the pace to
Yeah,
where
he it was very
Prado.
un-Ken Roczen like. You know how he like he usually sprints and kills everyone for the first like if he can get in the lead, he's usually gone. But he almost like stopped himself from doing that
Well, it was
and
such a
it created pressure for Hunter, I think.
to that point, I feel that Hunter, the Lawrence camp, plays chess. Everybody plays checkers. You know, Jet is just Jet, and Hunter has shown himself to be that second guy. You know, and it's like Hunter in his head as a racer was in the perfect spot. This is where I'm supposed to be. You know, there's plan A and plan B. Plan B, I'm sitting behind him. And by Hunter being what I feel a little bit passive early in the race, in hopes that I'm just going to wear him down, Kenny played chess and his camp caught everybody off guard in the sense of he pushed, allowed Prado to push up, created the pressure. And when things, you know, all of a sudden now, the pressure of winning a championship. It's the longest race in the world. It feels like a 3-hour race, you know, even at Loretta's. It is just murderously, you know, boring is not the right word, but it's murderously just slow.
Oh, dude, when you're battling Carter Halpine for like the billionth time, when he is like sweating you at the end of the third moto at Loretta's 17 minutes in, yeah, I can imagine.
Well, I think to that point at Loretta's, my dad broke down Loretta's to a math equation. And I always said I would write a book on Loretta's. Sad part is it would probably have to be an audiobook.
That's fine. For anybody, oh, for it to be consumed by the motocross industry, yes.
Yeah, it would have to be a bit of an audiobook. But you know, Loretta's, if you're the top guy, if you're the first, second, or third place guy, this only equates to them. But you know, you pick one out of 42 chips to determine your first gate pick. So it's a likely probability, especially with 42 gates. You technically have a higher probability to pull a bad chip than you do a good chip.
Right, given the fact that there's probably only 10 good chips and there's
Yes.
40.
So out of 42 chips, if I pull I'd say 1 through 15, I'm going to have a good enough, obviously, I'm going to have a gate to win this race.
Yeah.
If I pull 15 through 30, I'm going to have an average starting position. So the mindset, if I'm 1 through 15, my mindset's to win the first moto. Okay. If I'm 15 through 30, I just need to get second. There's no difference. You can throw away a championship, a year long of training, all these things you work for in the first moto. The
Right.
championship to me is won in the second moto. And if you're 30 to 42, just try and get third. And if you get into second, that's it. If you look at my
Yeah.
seven titles, I went 1-1-1 one time in 2009.
Yeah.
So,
I'm just looking up the times you didn't win and like yeah, like Super Mini won in 2014, you went 8-8-4.
yeah, and like
Do you remember
those
what your
years,
worst gate pick was, first moto?
I tell you, I super many year I don't remember. I remember being very young amongst the class.
Yeah.
The year, I can always remember the years I won, of course. I try not to remember the years I didn't. I did pull one a handful of times at Loretta's, ironically. I pulled my share of 40s and 38s. But I think, too, like my last year in the B class, there's all this pressure on the line for a big pro contract. I pulled 39th gate pick. I have the chip. We have all the chips in my parents' house. And I remember it was a mud race. Fast in Loretta's 250B. And I get off the gate and I sat behind Max Markov. It was Mitchell Faulk, Max Markov, and myself. And Marchbanks is nowhere to be found. And he's the guy I'm directly competing against. Like he's just as fast as me. He is the guy. And so I sit there in third forever. I slipped around Markov and Faulk was gone. And it was a mud race. I had no desire to win the race. Zero. And then Mitchell Faulk ends up going down. I win the first moto. Second moto comes around. It's an even worse of a mud race. I'm out front, winning the race. Marchbanks is behind me. Marchbanks got 30 something the first moto. He's out of this title. What do
Yeah,
I
no, it's
do?
over.
I pull over for the guy. There's no sense for me to race this dude.
Yeah, no, he went 21-1-7.
Yeah, so I pull over for him the second moto. He goes around me, he wins, I get second. The math. So I get to the final moto. Cameron Cannon that year had to win the final moto. If he won the final moto, I couldn't get worse than seventh.
Right, and you weren't losing to Luke Hempin.
Yeah, like I didn't even. This class got so jumbled up from the mud
Yeah.
that, we had all the math on everybody, but Cameron Cannon was the only dude that could win the title, really. And I had to finish worse than seventh. So the final moto, I got into the lead and I was like, what do I do? Like, I'm out here rolling around and for 20 minutes. And then Jake Masterpool was trying to career it. And I remember I like pull over for him and it was the longest 20, like people asked, what was the hardest race? Like that was one of them. I'm just sitting there like, is
Yeah.
this thing going to end? And I feel like I won that title. Of course, I was the best guy, but also too, had it down to math.
Right, yeah, because
Like
if you
I
look at it now,
couldn't.
like Falk went 3-10-5. He would have had to win and you got like ninth, which wasn't gonna happen. Like you and
Yeah.
Kevin Moranz didn't exactly have a lot of drag out you Zane Merritt and Kevin Morantz as amateurs. It's not
Yeah,
the
so
same
like
conversation.
and no disrespect to like Kevin Moranz, I didn't
Yeah.
even know who he was.
Of course. He's gone on. He's stuck. That's a guy who stuck with it.
That's a guy who came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And like I remember
Peak of
meeting him, he's like,
Cannons.
I raced you so many times. I'm like, I don't even know who you are. And
Yeah.
kudos to that guy for really like getting significantly better
Yes, sir.
to making main events is insanity.
And seemingly has made money at this sport,
Yeah.
which is rare for the guys in
It
his
is rare.
position.
And I talked to Kevin at Daytona and he's a character, but that's where I think kids, for me, the easiest race was Marchbanks straight up beat me the second moto or the first moto. And this is where the math equates. I pulled first gate pick in Schoolboy 2. And
Okay.
now Marchbanks is out of the 250B title. So now Schoolboy 2 is everything for us. And at that point, Mitchell Faulk wasn't racing the class. It was really just me and Marchbanks in this class. And first moto, I pull the hole shot with first gate pick. He passes me and beats me. And I'm like, man, like convincingly beat me. But this is why I always say the second moto wins Loretta's. If you put yourself in the opportunity to succeed. That second moto, I remember getting fired up. Big Brian, Colleen, Little Brian, like they got me fired up because I know I have to win this race. And the gate drops and I just take it to him like he did to me the first moto. So, but where the difference is though, the last thing he's going to remember is that I won convincingly. So
Right.
now, even though we're tied in points, in my head, I've already forgotten about the first moto. I only remember that I won the second moto.
Right, you got all the momentum.
Yeah. So now I have the momentum. I get the hole shot. He's second. And I'm thinking it's on now. Like it's on. So that way too, why I say, you know, this is a black or white race. This is whoever wins, best man wins, is going to win this championship. And I believe he ended up going down behind me at some point in the race.
Yeah, he gets
And
33rd.
yeah. But again, I think this is all down in a weird way for the top guys. It is a bit of math. If you told a kid with 42nd gate pick is the fastest guy in the class to go out there and get second, he's going to have way less sense of urgency. He's going to have way less sense of risk of crashing and throwing away a title than if you tell him from 42nd gate pick, he needs to go out there and win the first moto. It means nothing to win the first moto. It means
Yeah.
everything when you get 10th in the first moto. It's over.
Yeah, because you can't recover from that. Because it's not a points championship. It's like it's based off of the result. Is like
Yeah.
a two. If you're sitting on two and a one, like you're in the driver's seat, and that's exactly where you were
Yeah, I
at.
mean, even
Actually,
if you go
even with
three
Tanner
one
Stack
one.
right there too.
Yeah, I mean, even if you go 3-1-1, you're gonna win a championship. And it's like, but when you start, you know, in that first moto, it's rare that the top guy, extremely rare that the top guy personally chokes the last moto. Like it's just really never happened. You see all these crazy titles by guys going 8-4-1 to win a title. But why did the top guy allow that to happen? You know, I think you look at Kenny, the things kids should study is like you look at Kenny's Saturday at Salt Lake City. Was off the pace. Was off the pace in practice. Was, you know, fast in the heat race, but it seemed like he was overly urgent. But then the main event came around and, you know, that just more respect to the guy and his team. He believed, one, and he put himself in a position to succeed and fail. Hunter Lawrence put himself in a position to succeed and fail. Unfortunately, Hunter got the bad end of the stick. You know, and you can replay it. I should have done it this way and this way and this way, but Hunter knows he never did anything to start that race that put him in a position to not succeed. You know, it would have been a lot harder to lose a championship if I allowed myself to get a 10th place start, couldn't work my way through the field. The race was over in 8 minutes, and that's it. You know, he had his opportunity. Kenny had the opportunity, and Kenny was just better. You know, and but you look at what Kenny did. Kenny finished what? Fifth?
Think so, yeah, eventually. Like if you see that a lot with guys who have like they when they win the championship, it's almost like a emotional, physical
Yeah.
just drain where they just like they have it wrapped up so they can't get themselves to mentally go to that like sicko place in your brain where you have to go faster than everyone
Well, there's
around you.
just no need.
Yeah, there's no need to. So like you just can't.
That's where I think kids should get better of, you know, learning of their surroundings,
Yeah.
of understanding where you're at. You don't need to win every race to be a Loretta Lynn champion. I proved it. I won 6 times without winning every race.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need to win every single race you see at the ranch to be a pro one day. You just need to be smart. Like Ryan Dungey was the king at it. He changed the landscape of Supercross. He proved to everybody by finishing on the podium every weekend was more beneficial than trying to win every race.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe, like you could argue that Ryan Dungey is the worst thing that could ever happen to a place like Loretta's because it almost, it's like that's your proof that you don't need to win there.
No, it is. And I think too, you know, on that, you know, you've heard it for years. Loretta's isn't the most important. I'm biased because I won there so many times, but it is the one opportunity to show the world of under that pressure, there is not another Loretta's. There's another Futures race. You know, there's four or five class. There's four classes to do at Spring Nationals. There's two classes. You have two opportunities. There is, you cannot have one bad moto. It is this. And that's it. And, you know, all eyes are on you. You get to see what the kid's made of under pressure, one. And two, the funniest part about Loretta's is it's probably the easiest track they race all year.
Right. And well, that is also maybe like I always tell people about that is that like that might be the ultimate equalizer is that there's not a single obstacle on the track that like it really favors anybody. Like everyone goes, everyone's tripling through the Ten Commandments now. Like everyone can do those corners. Everyone can do the big double in the middle. Like it's you're splitting hairs there. And then you also happen to have the 42 fastest guys from every corner of the country.
Yeah, I mean, there's what, like a handful of jumps that you can call jumps. I mean,
Yeah.
but I think what it shows to the math equation of the world is, parents with kids that are the best riders needs to watch races. I guarantee you the hole shot's going to come from a similar gate every time. Zach Bell and I lined up in the same gate in 2012 when he dominated the pro sport class. It was gate 8 right at the doghouse. We went there. The 85, 9 to 11 in pro sport lined up every race, and he was behind me, and we lined up in that gate every single time. And I have a photo of like one of the biggest hole shots ever from the middle of the gate of Loretta's. And it was because of the gate. Parents need to pay attention to these things. It's important where you line up. But also, too, Loretta's, you can win that race in four corners if you're the top guy. The old track, it's obviously changed the layout from when I was racing Loretta's. But the old layout where it was those singles after the start, if you got the hole shot and dodged that first single, and you probably dodged the second single and you got clean through all the way through Storyland, the gap you would have on the field was substantial.
Oh, it can be like 20 seconds on lap one.
Yeah, so if its top guy gets a terrible start and he's only worried about the leader, it's not a good feeling on lap one or two when you see the leader coming out of Storyland and you're heading into Storyland.
Yeah, or you're coming out of Storyland and you see them hitting that tabletop heading back towards
Exactly.
them, and you're like, oh shit, I
Yeah,
haven't even hit the sand yet.
I had my share of that. I'll tell you, there, fuck, I got a middle finger from my dad one year.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm sure he's hanging off the billboard corner.
Came around in 38th, got a middle finger. He was never in the mechanics area. And came around, got a middle finger, and then I ended up winning the race from like dead last. And I go, years later, I go, he goes, yeah, that was a little premature. He goes, but it lit a fire in my ass, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, like I guess it proves effective. I gotta ask, who would you say is your Mount Rushmore of your amateur rivals or the guys that you raced against? Who were the four baddest dudes that you competed against? Maybe they got your numbers, maybe sometimes you had theirs. Who's those four guys that like basically like those were the best competitors I competed against.
I'd say guys that I personally raced, I'd put, and I personally raced in amateur racing. Chase is up there. Chase is definitely on that. Just between, like, Chase was a hard guy to race. That's why I always respected Chase. He's a great buddy of mine. He was just a guy that you knew wasn't going to go away. Like, he had such good technique. He didn't do anything wrong on the bike. Like it is just a guy that you knew you had to somehow find a way to beat him. Fortner, no question on that list. Fortner was a guy that my amateur career, Super Mini in that first year of the B class, I mean, that guy was decimating us. I mean, it wasn't even close. Like it
Yeah,
wasn't even
when you got
close.
second in Schoolboy 2 in 15, that was to Austin Fortner.
Yeah, no, I never even saw him. I think I got second in a moto maybe. I don't think I ever saw him.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy was on a whole nother level. So he's no question up there. Justin Cooper, my last year pro sport, not so much on the 250. The way that guy rode the 450, not only did it piss me off to no end on a 250, eating his rocks all year. Like he was a guy that just made it look easy.
Yeah.
Like
There's
he
not a lot of
never,
18-year-olds that ride a 450 and make it look easy by any
no,
means.
I mean, he was like, didn't rev the bike, like, didn't, you were just like, how's this guy just smoking me? So he's definitely, and then the last one, That's a tricky one because the last one, like, I'm not going to put myself, but I mean, I'd have to say Adam Cincirillo, even though I never raced him. I did race him one time. There was some crazy 9 to 15 class at an old NMA race that, I should say I was in a race that he was in,
Yeah.
with Cooper Webb too. I'm just name dropping legends,
Sure.
but I will
That's
say
okay.
Adam to me was the best amateur to ever do it in the sense of no kid will ever ride a super mini that good.
No, I think I think he is the all-time in my opinion, undisputed super mini champion of the world. That guy on a KX 100 or whatever the hell it
Yeah.
was. That thing was just special. Like, it's 'cause
I mean,
he was so small on it, but he fit it well. And it was just the urgency that he rode with. It was just, yeah.
that I can't leave him. I mean, because there's like Sean Cantrell was very solid. I mean, Chalon Tennant, when he was on the Star Yamaha, would have flashes of just like insane speed at
Yeah.
times and would just wipe out. I mean, the same with kind of Mosman would out of nowhere win a race and then yard sale. Sean was a, I'd say Sean and myself rode very similarly. Like we had good technique. We didn't really take a lot of chances. You know, it was kind of, we won by just being better. We weren't sketchy. But Adam, and he's like a brother to me growing up seeing him. I mean, I'll say for the record, Zach Freeberg won the pro sport class at Loretta's over Jason Anderson. And Adam could be just as good as him, if not better, during the week on a super mini. So like
Yeah.
for people at home listening, to put that in perspective
On a
of take your,
carbureted two-stroke.
yeah, I mean, take your super mini kid and put him up against a pro sport. And to think that Adam could do that was just, it's unfathomable.
Yeah. And Freeberg's another one of those guys that, like, I feel like, and it goes back to sort of like the meat grinder of motocross, but pro sport in general is just that there are so many guys that, like, they had unbelievable skills to pay the bills. And unfortunately, there's just not enough seats that pay in this sport. You know what
Yeah.
I mean?
Oh, 100%.
Who, if you could do a all-time golfing trip, but you have to pick moto guys as your four. So who's the other three guys in your foursome on the most epic golfing trip? Who are you golfing with, and where are you golfing is the most important part.
I'm taking Chase and Adam for sure.
Good trip so far.
I'm taking James Stewart,
Okay.
and I'm taking the GOAT, man, Ricky Carmichael.
You think Carmichael can swing the sticks?
Yeah, I've seen him swing the sticks. He doesn't make it publicly.
Okay. Interesting. I didn't
We
know
used to be
that.
members at the same course. Ricky, I wouldn't say he's an avid golfer, or he's, I would say he's an avid golfer. I wouldn't say that he golfs nearly as much as you would want to. But the guy's got some game. And James, I've had the
I've heard
pleasure to
James is a
play
good
with
golfer.
James. James is a good golfer. I've had the pleasure to play with him a few times. I've played with Chase and Adam. I would say that foursome, well, that'd be five.
Yeah, you gotta,
Shit, I gotta ditch one.
now you've backed yourself into a hole. Are you clipping the goat? James
That's
Stewart.
tricky because I mean I would love to see like their rivalry on the golf course, you know, because you know it's still in there.
Yeah.
You know those guys are as competitive as it gets. Man, I'd probably clip Chase, and I have reasoning behind that. I have reasoning as Chase is my boy, and we have, you know, we talk about golf more than anything.
Yeah.
I would clip him for the sake, because he's still racing.
Is he still there as like vibes guy though? Like, can he be a caddying, or maybe he's just your
No,
vlogging? No.
no way.
Okay,
No
good.
way. Chase isn't a vibe guy. He's too serious.
All right, fair enough.
You know,
Fair
I
enough.
was the guy eating Firehouse subs, and Chase was eating like, you know, salads.
Firehouse goes so hard though.
Dude, Chase was living through me those years on Geico. That's probably why I play golf and he races for Factory Kawasaki. But yeah, I'm clipping Chase because one, I could never clip the two guys, the three guys that got me in the sport. They pretty much ruined it for me. I was destined to be Tiger Woods, 15 years ago.
Yeah. So would it be you and Adam versus Ricky and James? And in stroke play, do you think you're beating those guys?
Yeah, I mean, they'd have to get a hefty amount of strokes. I feel like Adam would somehow hustle me. He would get like, I'd have to give him way too many strokes. He would claim that he's like really bad, and then he'd
Well,
beat me
he's playing that
somehow.
game for sure. He's like, oh, yeah, like the shoulder and the
You know,
wrist. Like,
like
I
the
don't
typical
have
like
it.
old man body, like I feel like Adam would somehow hustle me. I feel like Ricky would be too hard to compete against because I just see that guy like grinding every hole out. I mean, the dude just seems like a guy who like would shoot, an 83, 82, 85, and it would probably look like he shot 100. And then you tally it up and you're like, wow, this guy just hit every sand trap, got it up and down every hole. And then James is a sneaky one because James has some of the best short game I've ever seen.
I could see that, which is fun. Yeah, I could see that.
Which
I
is
could see that.
surprising because, now that I play professionally, I've seen obviously some of the best in the world to do it. But James, man, because he's a private dude, I'll tell you, that guy, sneaky, sneaky.
Well, I think the commonality between actually all three of those guys is that none of them like to be bad at anything.
Of course.
And if they're gonna do anything, they're like, and like James and Ricky did, they're gonna go off to like they would probably rent out an entire driving range. Be like,
Oh
no,
yeah.
I'm figuring this out
I could
today.
totally see this golf trip. Let's say we go to Pebble Beach, turning into a fun thing to start with, and then on the way home, everybody's hiring coaches.
No one's talking to each other.
No, and it's like they're hiring coaches. They're getting, so next year comes around, it's going to be like a full-fledged just war. 'Cause that's these guys, I'll tell you, their competitiveness is something that people can't handle. The average person, for sure.
I also think that vlogging that round of golf might break the, not the entire internet, because we already established that like most people don't know who the hell those people are, but like the motocross internet in our
Oh.
small little world, I know like Barstool does those like sandbaggers.
Yeah.
That like if you did a sandbagger with RC, AC, and JS7 with yourself, just like probably 600 par. Yeah, that would break our version of the internet.
I tell you, we might, there'd be a lot of editing.
Yes.
There'd be a lot, whoever's the editor would, well, I'll tell you what, he's gonna be busy after that one because those guys are no question battling to the death.
You have to get fancy with the cutting tool. Jordan Bailey on his first ever appearance on the Big MX Radio podcast. I refuse to let that be the only time. It's way too interesting of a conversation, but it has been 2 hours and you probably have to either get to
Shit.
bed or, yeah, just like, I'm really happy with the conversation, man. This has been so much fun. I feel like we went down every little rabbit hole that we possibly could have. But this has been great, man. I think I need to have you and Adam on just to like go back and forth some stories and stuff like that. And, yeah, this has been amazing. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I look forward to doing this again.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, where can people keep up with you, and follow along with your journey in pro golf?
Just on my Instagram, JordanBailey133. I need to be better about posting things, but I try and post some things on there. Then
Just
hopefully,
focus on golf.
when we make it big, man, you'll just tune into TV.
Fair enough. Yeah, the next time I hear you'll be replacing Max Homa on those the annual interview before the Masters.
Exactly. I just want a Chipotle sponsor.
Hell yeah. All right, Jordan Bailey here on the Big MX Radio podcast. Do not hang up just yet, my friend, but for the podcast's sake, we're going to cut things off right there.